Accessibility and inclusivity are so important, but movements can sometimes be inadvertently ableist. How can we prioritize disability justice for a stronger climate justice movement?
Welcome to Climate Organizing Shorts, where we're having short but inspiring conversations with climate organizers to help give you ideas for how you can build momentum for change in your community.
Climate Organizing Shorts is a collaboration between Pullback Podcast and the Climate Justice Organizing Hub. I'm Kyla Hewson, and I'm here with Kristen Pugh.
On today's episode, we spoke with Daniel Sarah Karasik, who is a published author, co-founder of the network Artists for Climate and Migrant Justice and Indigenous Sovereignty, as well as the founding managing editor of Midnight Sun, which is a magazine of socialist strategy and analysis. Daniel Sarah coordinated the Suppress the Virus Now Coalition for Health Justice in Ontario during the second and third waves of the COVID-19 pandemic, and has been an outspoken advocate for a liberatory left vision of public health.
Listen in to explore common accessibility challenges at climate events, effective strategies for enhancing the accessibility of your campaigns, and the significance of disability justice within the climate movement. Here we go. What got you into the activism space?
So I was working as an artist and as a writer, and my art itself was sort of increasingly, you know, grappling with what is the relationship between, you know, art and literature and, you know, broader social forms, right? Like, as opposed to a vision of art and literature that is just about, that is primarily about itself or primarily about sort of like conversations within art disciplines or whatever. I think I was just sort of intuitively, as one does, you know, sort of becoming curious about what are the relationships between, you know, cultural production and other layers of our society, other sort of forces in our society. And then, you know, thinking about how art is institutionalized and, you know, what are the relationships that the institutions have to the state and to capitalism and the ruling class and other kinds of social forces. And then I became very deeply preoccupied, maybe I guess the better part of 10 years ago now, with abolition, with sort of abolitionist politics, specifically prison abolition. I was really, I think for a variety of reasons that were in many cases like pretty sort of indirect or atmospheric, I was just like deeply preoccupied with the role of prisons and carceral violence in our society and just how sort of normalized this like really like extreme violence is, like as a way of, you know, sort of structuring society and like kind of disciplining people by the threat of it. And started to do sort of some work with prisoners. Like I was doing a master's in Chicago, I guess 8 years ago or something now. Wow, it feels like a long time. And I was like doing some work with prisoners in a jail, kind of leading writing workshops and just kind of confirming or affirming some intuitions about just like the horrors of state violence. And then moved back to Toronto and was also looking for ways to sort of do that work. And I think for me, like my sort of analysis of what became for me like an anti-capitalist and, you know, a socialist analysis was really actually rooted in the first instance in like this sort of deep horror of state violence, like as I sort of became aware of its scope and desire to better understand it and understand how and why it was normalized. And then from there, I think I started to become curious and sort of find, you know, relationships that helped me educate myself more about the ways that capitalism and destruction of the planet and destruction of human bodies and through state violence of different kinds are all, you know, deeply interwoven and interdependent, and then was looking for ways to intervene, you know, as an individual, looking for collective ways to intervene that could be effective, and, you know, found activist spaces, I think, in that way. And then was, you know, I would say most active sort of for a while in the Fight for 15 and Fairness campaign, which is now called Justice for Workers here in Toronto, where I live, which was just like an amazing, like sort of multiracial, intergenerational organizing space dedicated to labor justice, but really sort of intervening on all kinds of other issues too, with an anti-capitalist analysis that was like partly explicit and partly sort of like a little bit oblique, so that, you know, lots of people with lots of different kinds of experience could be drawn in and organized in that movement. So that was kind of where I think I started, or at least that was like really sort of foundational or formative for me.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I think that your sort of experience really, it really drives home maybe something that we're observing in sort of the climate movement overall, because you come from a really sort of, at least from what you're saying, a really deep background in looking at different types of justice. And so connecting that to climate change, I think, is something that a lot of people are starting to do, whether it's sort of like the, you know, carceral aspects that you were talking about or capitalism, things like that. So I'm wondering whether you could talk a little bit about disability justice specifically, because that's something that a lot of climate organizers are really, I think, interested in. And I'd love to hear more if you have perspectives on that.
Yeah, I think that the system through which climate justice and disability justice meet, for me, or the way that I think about it, is capitalism. I mean, is the ways that capitalism, that inflection point or that meeting point, is the ways that capitalism depends on, I mean, depends on many things, but two important forms of violence that, you know, overlap in different ways. One is the extraction of and from land, so dispossession of people from land for the sake of accumulating wealth, for the sake of sort of privatizing what was previously commonly held spaces, privatizing resources for profit. And separately, but overlapping and intersecting in some ways, the ways that capitalism depends on the exploitation of human labor in ways that are at best agnostic to the effects of that exploitation on the human body. So that, you know, the ways that to accumulate value or profit, capitalists or bosses, managers, whatever, are often seeking in various ways by various strategies to extract more and more sort of labor from people who have bodies that are, you know, finite. And so whether it's like intense manual labor, or it's the ways that even are like other forms of labor we may think of as sort of like disabling or as hard on the body, you know, also like take a toll day after day. And that both of these sorts of processes, you know, both the sort of extraction, dispossession with respect to land, and the same with respect to sort of human bodies, are of course overlapping in many ways. And they're fundamentally about a relatively small number of people accumulating wealth at the expense of others. And that sort of shows up in a variety of ways. But I think that the people who end up losing out the most, or who end up harmed by those processes, are often a lot of the same people, which is most of us. So I think that obviously, you know, you could make a case in different ways, case by case, for the specific sort of points of intersection of a climate justice struggle and a disability justice struggle, be it sort of a case of like environmental racism, where, you know, some sort of privatization and exploitation of land is like actively causing, you know, health harms to a community sort of like local to that site of extraction or something. Or you look at the ways that in our movements, there are these sorts of intersection points, and just in the ways we organize in the sort of micro of our organizing spaces, you know, looking at how do we hold the needs of disability justice and alongside some of the more kind of maybe macro questions of climate justice. But yeah, I think it's like often like very sort of context specific, like what those particular intersection points are. But I think they're everywhere because of the ways that capitalism structures both like ableism and sort of climate violence.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, that there's an immense amount of sort of harmony between climate justice and disability justice and other forms of justice. Are there any examples that come to mind for you for those sort of specific intersections, like where you've seen disability justice really taken seriously and incorporated in messaging and goals well in a climate movement?
You know, one thing that comes up for me a lot these days when I think about disability justice and organizing around climate justice, but and also around lots of other issues or struggles, is the way that the ongoing pandemic, the way that COVID is being sort of like held in movements and in organizing spaces today. And I really appreciate when the ongoingness of the pandemic and the need to take care of people who are, of all of us, you know, the need to take care of people who are most vulnerable to COVID, but also to acknowledge that we all continue to be vulnerable to this virus that causes long-term illness in a kind of pretty striking number of proportionate cases. So for example, masking, like at, you know, in organizing spaces or at rallies, when that is part of the accessibility considerations that get named, I think that for me, especially when it is connected to some kind of analysis of how we can't leave people behind, you know, if we're organizing in these ways, I really appreciate that. You know, I think sometimes when we talk about climate justice organizing, we're looking at issues that can seem so huge, right? Sort of like forms of violence, forms of extraction that can feel really like not on a human scale, or like that are happening on such a kind of like global and transnational scale that it's really difficult to kind of see the impact of some of our actions. I mean, obviously, we can see that in small ways, and I really think in that kind of context, the ways that we are relating to each other our relationships and the kinds of care that we take in our organizing spaces is so critical, because we have so much more direct control over that. And it's not as if that is enough. It's not as if that is going to change some of these macro dynamics. But I find it really important. And I think I always appreciate when I see organizations taking that seriously, as I've seen, for example, like Climate Justice Toronto, I think has been really great about taking some of those considerations seriously, thinking about access to organizing spaces and to actions, and really kind of reflecting, I think, on some of the ways that access to certain kinds of organizing can be challenging and can be like what some of the barriers can be to that.
Yeah, I really like that point that there are kind of two levels at which organizers can promote disability justice. And one is sort of the broader messaging, but another one that you're saying is really appreciated is also just making sure the movement's accessible and what it does. On that theme, and recognizing that there are such a variety of ways in which disabilities affect people, but wondering if you could talk about some common accessibility barriers that might come up at climate events or in climate organizing spaces, and maybe some best practices for addressing those.
One barrier, one sort of like way of thinking about organizing that I think can cause problems in this way is a kind of romance of being in the streets, of putting your body in harm's way, you know, of putting your body like in the gears of, you know, of the machine. And that isn't to say that there isn't an important place for that kind of that, you know, that way of showing up. I think it is worthy of like respect and support. And I think that there can be a danger that what is like seen as the real work of organizing actually requires like a kind of able-bodied capacity in some pretty significant ways, such that people who may feel like they don't have that capacity or don't have that capacity to, you know, the extent necessary or whatever, may feel like, you know, organizing isn't for them or social movement sort of spaces aren't for them. You know, the ways that so many organizing spaces, sort of progressive social justice oriented spaces, dropped masking, you know, indoors and meetings in the past couple of years have done that, I think is really tough. It signals so strongly that those who, for whatever reason, continue to sort of take COVID seriously are really sort of implicitly not welcomed, I think, into those spaces. There are so many different ways that people can contribute to movement building work. But I think that there's sometimes a bit of a tension between like the, you know, rhetoric around that and the kinds of work that actually gets valued or that actually gets sort of emphasized. And one of the ways that I think that I find helpful to think about some of those distinctions is that if our movements are going to be successful, then the work that's really critical, or that I would argue is sort of most critical, is the work of long-term capacity building, is the work of sort of building networks, organizations, or relationships, or whatever the scale is, that can last through multiple cycles of struggle, that can last through, you know, many challenges, because our enemies are getting organized that way. It's a very high level of organization, I would argue, on the far right, you know, among capitalists and so on. And if we can't do that kind of sustainable work, I really don't know how like resistance to these very organized forces on the other side of these struggles can be successful. And so the kinds of work that are like long-term capacity building efforts, to me, that can look so many different ways, right? Like that doesn't have to mean, you know, the high risk direct action. It might look like that in some contexts, but it also can mean getting on the phone with somebody or sending some emails or thinking through some like organizational infrastructure of some kind, or, you know, many, many things that people can access depending on their capacity in different ways. So kind of centering that like long-term vision can help. I think it's really helpful just to be clear when planning events or organizing, just to be clear about like the scope of those events. So like, what is the runtime? You know, what is the physical layout of the space, including if it's like the street? Where are the bathrooms? Are there bathrooms? You know, like having sort of marshals or others to make sure nobody's being left behind, getting clear on like what people are signing up for if they show up, and also like kind of estimating risk levels of different kinds. And obviously that's not always knowable exactly. But for me, a huge part of it is just like giving people the information they need to make informed decisions, as opposed to, you know, trying to create, I don't think it's possible always to create like a fully accessible sort of situation in the context of a deeply ableist, structurally ableist society. But I think letting people know what they're likely to encounter is like a, you know, an important sort of mitigation.
I know you said it's not always possible, but if somebody's organizing a climate event, let's say it's like a protest or a march, what are some things they could potentially do that might make the space a more accessible one beyond sort of informing people?
Best practices or wise practices, such as, you know, moving at the speed of those who perhaps are moving the slowest, you know, like sort of not like moving the march in a way that is likely to physically leave people behind. Thinking around COVID, like having sort of a COVID policy, communicating that there is a risk of transmission of COVID outdoors. So please, if it is crowded, which protests and marches tend to be, wear an N95 or KN95 quality mask. I really think that we need to be sort of trying as much as possible to model the ways of relating to each other, including care in the ways that we sort of try to structure events. So, you know, an answer is made over the megaphone about like where the march is going, how to recognize the marshals, you know, like marshals are marked out clearly, and policy around how to relate to the police, you know, like don't talk to the police, like there's a police liaison, like these sorts of considerations that I think can give people the sense that there is like some structure to the event and that it's not sort of necessarily a space where there's nowhere to turn, just making it clear where support is located, providing water, you know, on a march, providing snacks, providing warming devices if it's cold out, you know, if people need that.
So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about sort of the variety of different disabilities that exist and how that might affect people's ability to engage in different ways.
Broadly speaking, it's really helpful to consider both sort of visible and invisible disabilities. I mean, I think, you know, like one thing that's coming to mind for me is noise, is sound as like a potential area of sort of access needed a protest or a march that may not be sort of quite as obvious as some others. But I know like this, just the sort of sensory intensity of, you know, those sorts of spaces can be really overwhelming for a lot of folks, including me. And, you know, thinking in advance about like, you know, are there earplugs available? Thinking about how, for example, fatigue or, you know, chronic pain may affect capacity to show up in certain ways. So like, how long is the march? How long is the meeting? You know, are there breaks built into these sorts of convenings or gatherings? Maintain a certain humility and not assume you know what people may be experiencing or may need. And really, because you can know, really building that kind of data seeking or information seeking and consent seeking, like into whatever the processes are for the work, where it is possible to sort of get a sense of, you know, what are the specific needs of a particular sort of constituency or particular sort of group of people, and can they be met? And if they can't be met in some ways, like can that be acknowledged in advance in a way that lets people make informed decisions? Like that for me is an important ethic, as opposed to sort of assuming that there's like a sort of set menu of access considerations that are sort of always relevant or always sort of like useful. And I do think there are some things that are kind of like, I would argue are pretty universally useful, like indicating bathroom access and, you know, masking in higher risk COVID contexts and stuff.
I'm wondering from like a process perspective, like for a movement that wants to make sure they're disability justice binded, do they set up a committee? What's the best way to do it to get that information that they'll need?
Creating a committee or sort of indicating that a couple of people are responsible for those considerations can be helpful. At the same time, it really feels like disability justice, it feels to me like disability justice should be something that is a shared set of agreements among everybody in a given group, anybody who's making decisions around, you know, the structure of an event or the structure of organizing, even if this is a sort of like both and, you know, like in addition to sort of delegating bottom line responsibility for these considerations of this work to a few people, it really feels to me like it should be part of the sort of like collective agreement, basis of unity, whatever the sort of shared principles of a group is, like commitments to opposing other forms of oppression within the group that may not be what the group is about. Like maybe the group is not focused specifically on trans liberation struggle or something, but, you know, there is a shared commitment, for example, to refusing transphobia, transmisogyny, you know, within the group. A commitment to disability justice and to really sort of figuring out together what that means in the specific sort of context of that group and its work should be that kind of shared commitment. And I think that when it is that kind of shared commitment and explicitly framed as such, it's less likely to get dismissed as a kind of distraction, you know, when there are competing priorities and when there's a lot of urgency because of the stakes of a situation that you're organizing around. You know, this sort of idea that we don't have time to think about these things considering these kinds of forms of oppression or considering ableism is like a luxury. Your horizon is building, you know, movements that can last and that have a chance of sort of sustaining themselves against like really significant, you know, sort of organized threats to, you know, the left broadly, to climate justice movements, certainly, then that for me reframes the sort of priority of disability justice, for example, within the movement, because you can't build a foundation for a movement that's going to last over the long haul that is fragmented because you haven't sort of prioritized those kinds of anti-oppressive forms of work.
To any organizations that are worried that planning for accessibility might be too much work, it's nice. It's just nice for everybody. Like even for people who maybe don't necessarily require those accessibility, I don't know. I went to an interview recently and they gave the interview questions 30 minutes in advance. And they were very clear about what I would see when I got there. So there's going to be this many stairs. You're going to go to this room. These are the questions you're going to be asked. So you have some time to think it over. And it was just, it's so nice to be at a space where everyone is being considered.
Sometimes I feel like some of the ways we talk about disability justice suggests that it's like special interest that's relevant like mostly to a small group of people who have like particular needs. But I mean, like as has been said by many others, like disability has the distinction of being like the one form of oppression that we will all experience if we live long enough, you know, and just the ways that like so many of these considerations, so many of these forms of support are certainly supportive to those who are disabled and who are, you know, sort of who name that, but are also helpful to so many of us who experience ableism in an ableist society, you know, regardless of the language that we may use at a given time to describe our position within that ableist society, you know? So I really love hearing about good access practices, good disability justice practices that accidentally, you know, make life better for like everybody or for so many people. Cause to me, that is also so like really the spirit of trying to resist ableism as like a structural factor of our society. When disability justice thinking is centered in these conversations or is, you know, sort of, it's clear that there's space for it. I think it also, one important thing it does is it empowers people to feel like they can bring up what their needs are. You know, like I think when there is a sense that dealing with the frailty of the, you know, obviously putting this in scare quotes, the frailty of the human mind and body, although, you know, also like the human mind and body are kind of frail in many respects. But, you know, when there's the sense that like we do not have time to deal with the frailty of the human mind and body, there's more important work to do. I think people don't really feel like they can name, like in many cases, like the ways that they may need support. And I feel like even if we don't anticipate in advance, like every need that folks might have, if we make it clear that there is space for those conversations and that they're not annoying and not a distraction, I think that in itself creates like much sort of, you know, psychologically safer spaces than is otherwise the case. So thanks a lot for just kind of creating energy behind that possibility.
If Daniel Sarah's work piqued your interest, you can subscribe to Midnight Sun, join the Artists for Climate and Migrant Justice and Indigenous Sovereignty Network, or pick up one of their books.
And if you want to learn more about the Climate Justice Organizing Hub and the work that they do, check out their wiki, which provides information and resources for activists in the climate justice movement.
The wiki is an excellent tool for information on all sorts of topics related to climate justice, topics like accessibility, burnout and care, movement structure, recruitment and retention, student organizing, and more. You can find a link to the wiki in the show notes or visit lahub.ca.